Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel avanzado C1. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
The invention of the chilled package sandwich, an accessory of modern British life which is so influential, so multifarious, and so close to hand that you're probably eating one right now, took place exactly 38 years ago. Like many things to do with the sandwich, this might seem, at first glance, to be improbable, but it is true. In the spring of 1980, Marks & Spencer, the nation's most powerful department store, began selling package sandwiches out on the shop floor. Nothing terribly fancy. Salmon and cucumber, egg and cress, triangles of white bread in plastic cartons in the food aisles, along with everything else. Prices started at 43p. Looking upon the nation's £8 billion a year sandwich industrial complex in 2018, it seems inconceivable that this had not been tried before. But it hadn't. Britain in 1980 was a land of formica counters, fluorescent lighting, and lunches under gravy. Sandwiches were thrown together from leftovers at home, constructed in front of you in a smoky cafe, or something sad and curled beneath the glass in a British Rail canteen. If anything, it seemed outlandish. Who would pay for something they could just as easily make at home? The first M&S sandwiches were made by shop staff in improvised kitchens and canteens. Prawns were defrosted in trays overnight, and a team of 5 came in before dawn to start work on the day's order. And oh, they sold. They sold so fast that the sandwich experiment spread from 5 stores to 25, and then 105. Without being designed to do so, the packaged sandwich spoke to a new way of living and working. Within a year, demand was so strong that M&S approached 3 suppliers to industrialise the process. In 1983, Margaret Thatcher visited the company's flagship store in Marble Arch and pronounced the prawn mayonnaise delicious. Every supermarket jumped on the trend. Up and down the country, chefs and bakers and assorted weeder dealers stopped whatever they were doing and started making sandwiches on industrial estates. The sandwich stopped being an afterthought, or a snack bought out of despair, and became the fuel of a dynamic, go-getting existence. By 1990, the British sandwich industry was worth £1 billion. A young economics graduate named Roger Whiteside was in charge of the M&S sandwich department by then. As a young buyer, Whiteside had come up with the idea of a set of 4 peeled oranges to save customers time. He had read that apartments were being built in New York without kitchens, and he had a sense of where things were going. "Once you're time-strapped and you've got cash, the first thing you do is get food made for you," he told me. "Who's going to cook unless you're a hobbyist?" In the sandwich department, he commissioned new prototypes every week and devised an ultimately impractical scheme to bake baguettes in West London each morning and deliver them, still crusty, to stores around the capital. Baguettes go soft when they are refrigerated, one of a surprising number of technical challenges posed by sandwiches. Whiteside immersed himself in questions of carriers, bread, barriers, butter, mayonnaise, inclusions, things inside the bread, proteins, tuna, chicken, bacon, until they bordered on the philosophical. What is more important, the carrier or the filling, he wondered. How many tiers of price do you offer in prawn? How much stimulation do people need? In the early 90s, Whiteside developed M&S's first dedicated food-to-go section, with its own tills and checkouts in Manchester. The innovation prefigured the layout of most contemporary supermarkets, and was fabulously successful. But it wasn't successful enough for Whiteside. He didn't understand why absolutely everyone in Manchester city centre wasn't coming into M&S for their lunch. One day he went into a branch of Boots on the other side of the street. Like almost every major retail chain, the pharmacy had followed M&S into the sandwich business. Boots established the country's first national distribution system, selling the same sandwiches in all its branches in 1985, and pioneered the meal deal. But Whiteside was convinced that its sandwiches weren't as good as M&S's, and that most customers knew that, too. He confronted the lunchtime queue in Boots and asked people why they weren't coming to his store. They said, "Well, I'm not crossing the road," he recalled. The answer struck Whiteside with great force. Mass-producing a meal that you could, if necessary, rip open and consume in the street was transforming people's behaviour. Instant gratification and total convenience and delivery, Whiteside said. If you're not there, they're not going to go looking for you. He returned from Manchester and tried to persuade M&S to open hundreds of standalone sandwich shops in London. It was so obviously an opportunity. M&S didn't go for the idea, but Whiteside was convinced that the future would belong to whoever was selling on every corner. He saw Pret and Starbucks and Costa and Subway coming a mile off. During the 1990s, the sandwich industry trebled in size. By the end of the 20th century, more people in Britain were making and selling sandwiches than working in agriculture. If you've been eating a packaged sandwich while listening to this, you'll have probably finished it by now. One industry estimate says that on average, they take 3.5 minutes to consume, but no one really knows, because no one pays attention. One of the great strengths of the sandwich over the centuries has been how naturally it grafts to our lives, enabling us to walk, read, take the bus, work, dream, and scan our devices at the same time as feeding ourselves with the aid of a few small rotational gestures of wrist and fingers.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
The invention of the chilled packaged sandwich, an accessory of modern British life which is so influential, so multifarious, and so close to hand that you're probably eating one right now, took place exactly 38 years ago. Like many things to do with the sandwich, this might seem, at first glance, to be improbable, but it is true. In the spring of 1980, Marks & Spencer, the nation's most powerful department store, began selling packaged sandwiches out on the shop floor. Nothing terribly fancy. Salmon and cucumber, egg and cress, triangles of white bread in plastic cartons in the food aisles, along with everything else. Prices started at 43p. Looking upon the nation's £8 billion a year sandwich industrial complex in 2018, it seems inconceivable that this had not been tried before. But it hadn't. Britain in 1980 was a land of formica counters, fluorescent lighting, and lunches under gravy. Sandwiches were thrown together from leftovers at home, constructed in front of you in a smoky cafe, or something sad and curled beneath the glass in a British Rail canteen. If anything, it seemed outlandish. Who would pay for something they could just as easily make at home? The first M&S sandwiches were made by shop staff in improvised kitchens and canteens. Prawns were defrosted in trays overnight, and a team of five came in before dawn to start work on the day's order. And oh, they sold. They sold so fast that the sandwich experiment spread from 5 stores to 25, and then 105. Without being designed to do so, the packaged sandwich spoke to a new way of living and working. Within a year, demand was so strong that M&S approached 3 suppliers to industrialise the process. In 1983, Margaret Thatcher visited the company's flagship store in Marble Arch and pronounced the prawn mayonnaise delicious. Every supermarket jumped on the trend. Up and down the country, chefs and bakers and assorted weeder dealers stopped whatever they were doing and started making sandwiches on industrial estates. The sandwich stopped being an afterthought, or a snack bought out of despair, and became the fuel of a dynamic, go-getting existence. By 1990, the British sandwich industry was worth £1 billion. A young economics graduate named Roger Whiteside was in charge of the M&S sandwich department by then. As a young buyer, Whiteside had come up with the idea of a set of 4 peeled oranges to save customers time. He had read that apartments were being built in New York without kitchens, and he had a sense of where things were going. "Once you're time-strapped and you've got cash, the first thing you do is get food made for you," he told me. "Who's going to cook unless you're a hobbyist?" In the sandwich department, he commissioned new prototypes every week and devised an ultimately impractical scheme to bake baguettes in West London each morning and deliver them, still crusty, to stores around the capital. Baguettes go soft when they are refrigerated, one of a surprising number of technical challenges posed by sandwiches. Whiteside immersed himself in questions of carriers, bread, barriers, butter, mayonnaise, inclusions, things inside the bread, proteins, tuna, chicken, bacon, until they bordered on the philosophical. What is more important, the carrier or the filling, he wondered. How many tiers of price do you offer in prawn? How much stimulation do people need? In the early 90s, Whiteside developed M&S's first dedicated food-to-go section, with its own tills and checkouts in Manchester. The innovation prefigured the layout of most contemporary supermarkets and was fabulously successful. But it wasn't successful enough for Whiteside. He didn't understand why absolutely everyone in Manchester city centre wasn't coming into M&S for their lunch. One day he went into a branch of Boots on the other side of the street. Like almost every major retail chain, the pharmacy had followed M&S into the sandwich business. Boots established the country's first national distribution system, selling the same sandwiches in all its branches in 1985, and pioneered the meal deal. But Whiteside was convinced that its sandwiches weren't as good as M&S's, and that most customers knew that, too. He confronted the lunchtime queue in Boots and asked people why they weren't coming to his store. They said, "Well, I'm not crossing the road," he recalled. The answer struck Whiteside with great force. Mass-producing a meal that you could, if necessary, rip open and consume in the street was transforming people's behaviour. Instant gratification and total convenience and delivery, Whiteside said. If you're not there, they're not going to go looking for you. He returned from Manchester and tried to persuade M&S to open hundreds of standalone sandwich shops in London. It was so obviously an opportunity. M&S didn't go for the idea, but Whiteside was convinced that the future would belong to whoever was selling on every corner. He saw Pret and Starbucks and Costa and Subway coming a mile off. During the 1990s, the sandwich industry trebled in size. By the end of the 20th century, more people in Britain were making and selling sandwiches than working in agriculture. If you've been eating a packaged sandwich while listening to this, you'll have probably finished it by now. One industry estimate says that on average, they take 3.5 minutes to consume. But no one really knows, because no one pays attention. One of the great strengths of the sandwich over the centuries has been how naturally it grafts to our lives, enabling us to walk, read, take the bus, work, dream, and scan our devices at the same time as feeding ourselves with the aid of a few small rotational gestures of wrist and fingers.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
The invention of the chilled package sandwich, an accessory of modern British life which is so influential, so multifarious, and so close to hand that you're probably eating one right now, took place exactly 38 years ago. Like many things to do with the sandwich, this might seem, at first glance, to be improbable, but it is true. In the spring of 1980, Marks & Spencer, the nation's most powerful department store, began selling packaged sandwiches out on the shop floor. Nothing terribly fancy. Salmon and cucumber, egg and cress, triangles of white bread in plastic cartons in the food aisles, along with everything else. Prices started at 43p. Looking upon the nation's £8 billion a year sandwich industrial complex in 2018, it seems inconceivable that this had not been tried before. But it hadn't. Britain in 1980 was a land of formica counters, fluorescent lighting, and lunches under gravy. Sandwiches were thrown together from leftovers at home, constructed in front of you in a smoky cafe, or something sad and curled beneath the glass in a British Rail canteen. If anything, it seemed outlandish. Who would pay for something they could just as easily make at home? The first M&S sandwiches were made by shop staff in improvised kitchens and canteens. Prawns were defrosted in trays overnight, and a team of five came in before dawn to start work on the day's order. And oh, they sold. They sold so fast that the sandwich experiment spread from 5 stores to 25, and then 105. Without being designed to do so, the packaged sandwich spoke to a new way of living and working. Within a year, demand was so strong that M&S approached 3 suppliers to industrialise the process. In 1983, Margaret Thatcher visited the company's flagship store in Marble Arch and pronounced the prawn mayonnaise delicious. Every supermarket jumped on the trend. Up and down the country, chefs and bakers and assorted weeder dealers stopped whatever they were doing and started making sandwiches on industrial estates. The sandwich stopped being an afterthought, or a snack bought out of despair, and became the fuel of a dynamic, go-getting existence. By 1990, the British sandwich industry was worth £1 billion. A young economics graduate named Roger Whiteside was in charge of the M&S sandwich department by then. As a young buyer, Whiteside had come up with the idea of a set of 4 peeled oranges to save customers time. He had read that apartments were being built in New York without kitchens, and he had a sense of where things were going. "Once you're time-strapped and you've got cash, the first thing you do is get food made for you," he told me. "Who's going to cook unless you're a hobbyist?" In the sandwich department, he commissioned new prototypes every week and devised an ultimately impractical scheme to bake baguettes in West London each morning and deliver them, still crusty, to stores around the capital. Baguettes go soft when they are refrigerated, one of a surprising number of technical challenges posed by sandwiches. Whiteside immersed himself in questions of carriers, bread, barriers, butter, mayonnaise, inclusions, things inside the bread, proteins, tuna, chicken, bacon, until they bordered on the philosophical. What is more important, the carrier or the filling, he wondered. How many tiers of price do you offer in prawn? How much stimulation do people need? In the early 90s, Whiteside developed M&S's first dedicated food-to-go section, with its own tills and checkouts in Manchester. The innovation prefigured the layout of most contemporary supermarkets, and was fabulously successful. But it wasn't successful enough for Whiteside. He didn't understand why absolutely everyone in Manchester city centre wasn't coming into M&S for their lunch. One day he went into a branch of Boots on the other side of the street. Like almost every major retail chain, the pharmacy had followed M&S into the sandwich business. Boots established the country's first national distribution system, selling the same sandwiches in all its branches in 1985, and pioneered the meal deal. But Whiteside was convinced that its sandwiches weren't as good as M&S's, and that most customers knew that, too. He confronted the lunchtime queue in Boots and asked people why they weren't coming to his store. They said, "Well, I'm not crossing the road," he recalled. The answer struck Whiteside with great force. Mass-producing a meal that you could, if necessary, rip open and consume in the street was transforming people's behaviour. Instant gratification and total convenience and delivery, Whiteside said. If you're not there, they're not going to go looking for you. He returned from Manchester and tried to persuade M&S to open hundreds of standalone sandwich shops in London. It was so obviously an opportunity. M&S didn't go for the idea, but Whiteside was convinced that the future would belong to whoever was selling on every corner. He saw Pret and Starbucks and Costa and Subway coming a mile off. During the 1990s, the sandwich industry trebled in size. By the end of the 20th century, more people in Britain were making and selling sandwiches than working in agriculture. If you've been eating a packaged sandwich while listening to this, you'll have probably finished it by now. One industry estimate says that on average, they take 3.5 minutes to consume. But no one really knows, because no one pays attention. One of the great strengths of the sandwich over the centuries has been how naturally it grafts to our lives, enabling us to walk, read, take the bus, work, dream and scan our devices at the same time as feeding ourselves with the aid of a few small rotational gestures of wrist and fingers.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 1.
Automatic cameras are great. I think they are, that's your go-to way of filming because they take all the decisions away from you that mean you're not concentrating on your subject matter. So I would say for most people, cameras today are so brilliant at finding the right exposure and finding the right focus point, even following your subject within a frame, that, you know, go for automatic.
Extract 2.
The reason why automatic settings are useful is that you've got to concentrate on so many different things in a classroom or in a school, because your subjects, there may be 30 of them in front of the camera and teachers as well, they're moving all the time and you have to be on the move. And so your focus will be changing, your exposure may be changing, all kinds of the technical aspects of what makes a good image will be changing, and you can't think about that. You have to think about what's happening in front of the camera, making sure you understand and follow the learning or whatever you're thinking about and concentrating on. I mean, in making a film, people aren't interested in focus and they expect you just to...
Extract 3.
Or if you're interviewing somebody or something of that kind, I think then it's probably better to go into manual because you've got time to set it up, your shots, and then you can make sure it looks and feels right to you. And so if you've got strong lighting, you might want to make sure that you're exposing for your subject, which might overexpose the background. The camera might not be very good at that. You can make that decision and make it right for your...
Extract 4.
The amount of light that is in the old days would be arriving on the film itself. The more light energy falls on the film, the quicker it turns black effectively. So nowadays with a sensor, we use the same kind of language. It's the amount of light that is falling on that sensor. And to get the best possible image, you need enough light, but you don't need too much light.
Extract 5.
Just right. Disposal, you have the aperture, which is literally the iris in the lens, which opens and closes. So the second thing is shutter speed. The higher the shutter speed, the faster it's taking pictures, the less light is getting through every time the shutter opens and closes. So a fast shutter speed is for bright light, and a slow shutter speed is for lower light levels. And then the third thing, which is a kind of more of a technical thing, is the ISO. That's the old language for film speed. We have an ISO number that is slow would be 25, 50, 100. Faster would be up to maybe 800 or 1600. So something of that kind would be considered reasonably fast. So if it's fast action, you need a fast speed. You need the aperture to be set so that you get enough light in the camera and you have an ISO, which is...
Extract 6.
It will look different because of the color of the light that's landing on the paper. So for example, in bright sunlight like this, this color temperature is very, very cold, okay? That's what we call it, cold. In other words, it's kind of slightly bluish. If you go inside and you have what's called tungsten lighting, which is much yellower, then this piece of paper would look yellower. So to make sure that it always comes across on your camera so that the white paper looks white, you have to get your white balance correct. So out here, you'd have a white balance which would be corrected for this nice cold light here, and it would look nice and white. Inside, if you were in tungsten lighting, you'd have to change your color balance, and it would probably be a tungsten color balance, and it would still look like a white piece of paper.
Extract 7.
Is in focus, or maybe just the subject, just the thing you're focusing on is in focus, and everything else is blurry. And the way you do that is through the aperture. As you widen the aperture, what happens is your depth of focus gets smaller and smaller. And as you close the aperture down, the depth of focus gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Play with it. I think the important thing with all of this is just play with the camera. Try out different things. And then
Extract 8.
You liked one. One that does the job of a tripod, which is make sure the camera doesn't move. And even if it's a windy day, and even if there's vibrations or whatever, you try to make sure the camera is absolutely still. You want to. Fundamentally, though, I think handheld is great if you're filming in a school, because that means you're very quick. You're quick to move around, find the subject matter, and you can take all those shots that include faces, what people are doing with their hands, how they might be talking to each other, wide shots so that you understand the context for what you're filming. You can get all those shots one after the other if you're handheld. So get used to the idea of trying to be your own tripod. Learn how to be really stable. Find ways you can lean on the wall. You can lean on a desk. You can find things that give you that stability without a tripod. But always have a tripod with you, because you never know when you're going to need one.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 1.
Automatic cameras are great. I think they are, that's your go-to way of filming, because they take all the decisions away from you that mean you're not concentrating on your subject matter. So I would say for most people, cameras today are so brilliant at finding the right exposure and finding the right focus point even following your subject within a frame, that, you know, go for automatic.
Extract 2.
The reason why automatic settings are useful is that you've got to concentrate on so many different things in a classroom or in a school, because your subjects, there may be 30 of them in front of the camera and teachers as well, they're moving all the time and you have to be on the move. And so your focus will be changing, your exposure may be changing, all kinds of the technical aspects of what makes a good image will be changing, and you can't think about that. You have to think about what's happening in front of the camera, making sure you understand and follow the learning or whatever you're thinking about and concentrating on. I mean, in making a film, people aren't interested in focus and they expect you just to...
Extract 3.
Or if you're interviewing somebody or something of that kind, I think then it's probably better to go into manual, because you've got time to set it up, your shots, and then you can make sure it looks and feels right to you. And so if you've got strong lighting, you might want to make sure that you're exposing for your subject, which might overexpose the background. The camera might not be very good at that. You can make that decision and make it right for your subject.
Extract 4.
The amount of light that is in the old days would be arriving on the film itself. The more light, the more light energy falls on the film, the quicker it turns black effectively. So nowadays with a sensor, we use the same kind of language. It's the amount of light that is falling on that sensor. And to get the best possible image, you need enough light, but you don't need too much light.
Extract 5.
Just right. Disposal, you have the aperture, which is literally the iris in the lens, which opens and closes. So the second thing is shutter speed. The higher the shutter speed, the faster it's taking pictures, the less light is getting through every time the shutter opens and closes. So a fast shutter speed is for bright light, and a slow shutter speed is for lower light levels. And then the third thing, which is a kind of more of a technical thing, is the ISO. That's the old language for film speed. We have an ISO number that is slow would be 25, 50, 100. Faster would be up to maybe 800 or 1600. So something of that kind would be considered reasonably fast. So if it's fast action, you need a fast speed. You need the aperture to be set so that you get enough light in the camera and you have an ISO, which is...
Extract 6.
It will look different because of the color of the light that's landing on the paper. So for example, in bright sunlight like this, this color temperature is very, very cold, okay? That's what we call it, cold. In other words, it's kind of slightly bluish. If you go inside and you have what's called tungsten lighting, which is much yellower, then this piece of paper would look yellower. So to make sure that it always comes across on your camera so that the white paper looks white, you have to get your white balance correct. So out here, you'd have a white balance which would be corrected for this nice cold light here, and it would look nice and white. Inside, if you were in tungsten lighting, you'd have to change your color balance, and it would probably be a tungsten color balance, and it would still look like a white piece of paper.
Extract 7.
Is in focus, or maybe just the subject, just the thing you're focusing on is in focus, and everything else is blurry. And the way you do that is through the aperture. As you widen the aperture, what happens is your depth of focus gets smaller and smaller. And as you close the aperture down, the depth of focus gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Play with it. I think the important thing with all of this is just play with the camera. Try out different things. And then
Extract 8.
You liked one. One that does the job of a tripod, which is make sure the camera doesn't move. And even if it's a windy day, and even if there's vibrations or whatever, you try to make sure the camera is absolutely still. You want to... Fundamentally, though, I think handheld is great if you're filming in a school, because that means you're very quick. You're quick to move around, find the subject matter, and you can take all those shots that include faces, what people are doing with their hands, how they might be talking to each other, wide shots so that you understand the context for what you're filming. You can get all those shots one after the other if you're handheld. So get used to the idea of trying to be your own tripod. Learn how to be really stable. Find ways you can lean on the wall, you can lean on a desk, you can find things that give you that stability without a tripod. But always have a tripod with you, because you never know when you're going to need one.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 1.
Automatic cameras are great. I think they are, that's your go-to way of filming because they take all the decisions away from you that mean you're not concentrating on your subject matter. So I would say for most people, cameras today are so brilliant at finding the right exposure and finding the right focus point, even following your subject within a frame, that, you know, go for automatic.
Extract 2.
The reason why automatic settings are useful is that you've got to concentrate on so many different things in a classroom or in a school, because your subjects, there may be 30 of them in front of the camera and teachers as well, they're moving all the time and you have to be on the move. And so your focus will be changing, your exposure may be changing, all kinds of the technical aspects of what makes a good image will be changing, and you can't think about that. You have to think about what's happening in front of the camera, making sure you understand and follow the learning or whatever you're thinking about and concentrating on. I mean, in making a film, people aren't interested in focus and they expect you just to...
Extract 3.
Or if you're interviewing somebody or something of that kind, I think then it's probably better to go into manual because you've got time to set it up your shots and then you can make sure it looks and feels right to you. And so if you've got strong lighting, you might want to make sure that you're exposing for your subject, which might overexpose the background. The camera might not be very good at that. You can make that decision and make it right for your subject.
Extract 4.
The amount of light that is in the old days would be arriving on the film itself. The more light energy falls on the film, the quicker it turns black effectively. So nowadays with a sensor, we use the same kind of language. It's the amount of light that is falling on that sensor. And to get the best possible image, you need enough light, but you don't need too much light.
Extract 5.
Just right. Disposal, you have the aperture, which is literally the iris in the lens, which opens and closes. So the second thing is shutter speed. The higher the shutter speed, the faster it's taking pictures, the less light is getting through every time the shutter opens and closes. So a fast shutter speed is for bright light, and a slow shutter speed is for lower light levels. And then the third thing, which is a kind of more of a technical thing, is the ISO. That's the old language for film speed. We have an ISO number that is slow would be 25, 50, 100. Faster would be up to maybe 800 or 1600. So something of that kind would be considered reasonably fast. So if it's fast action, you need a fast speed. You need the aperture to be set so that you get enough light in the camera and you have an ISO. Which
Extract 6.
It will look different because of the color of the light that's landing on the paper. So for example, in bright sunlight like this, this color temperature is very, very cold, okay? That's what we call it, cold. In other words, it's kind of slightly bluish. If you go inside and you have what's called tungsten lighting, which is much yellower, then this piece of paper would look yellower. So to make sure that it always comes across on your camera so that the white paper looks white, you have to get your white balance correct. So out here, you'd have a white balance which would be corrected for this nice cold light here, and it would look nice and white. Inside, if you were in tungsten lighting, you'd have to change your color balance and it would probably be a tungsten color balance and it would still look like a white piece of paper.
Extract 7.
Is in focus. Or maybe just the subject, just the thing you're focusing on is in focus and everything else is blurry. And the way you do that is through the aperture. As you widen the aperture, what happens is your depth of focus gets smaller and smaller. And as you close the aperture down, the depth of focus gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Play with it. I think the important thing with all of this is just play with the camera. Try out different things. And then
Extract 8.
You liked one. One that does the job of a tripod, which is make sure the camera doesn't move. And even if it's a windy day, and even if there's vibrations or whatever, you try to make sure the camera is absolutely still. You want to. Fundamentally, though, I think handheld is great if you're filming in a school, because that means you're very quick. You're quick to move around, find the subject matter, and you can take all those shots that include faces, what people are doing with their hands, how they might be talking to each other, wide shots so that you understand the context for what you're filming. You can get all those shots one after the other if you're handheld. So get used to the idea of trying to be your own tripod. Learn how to be really stable, find ways you can lean on the wall, you can lean on a desk, you can find things that give you that stability without a tripod. But always have a tripod with you because you never know when you're going to need one.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.